Welcome to the Lobot Lounge, the gathering place for the Gentlemen Nerds. The Gentlemen Nerds are three entertainment aficionados who know each other through various media endeavors, getting together to talk about all things nerdy, mostly in the vein of film, television, toys, and popular culture. Many topics are discussed, so please be warned, there are the potential for many spoilers. If you like what you hear, you can listen to past shows on iTunes or on our website, TheGentlemanNerds.com. And now, enjoy the show. A little table lamp named Luxo Jr. hopped into immortality in a short film of the same name produced by a relatively new player in animation, Pixar Animation Studios. Beginning with Toy Story in 1995, which was the very first computer animated feature film and its most recent being Incredibles 2, Pixar has produced 20 feature films, dozens of short films, and as of June 2018, its feature films have earned approximately $12 billion at the worldwide box office. The studio earned 19 Academy Awards, 8 Golden Globes, 11 Grammy Awards, many other awards and accomplishments. All in all, Pixar is pretty, well, incredible. So, it is with this that we gather to discuss Pixar and the latest box office hit, the sequel to Brad Bird's 2004 Pixar film, The Incredibles, The Incredibles 2. Which is a superhero family in the vein of the Fantastic Four and the Pretty Cool Three, which are gathered here today. In the lounge, we have Mark Finn.
It's clobbering time!
There you go. Aaron DeArrive.
When you say everybody's special, it means nobody is.
And I'm Joseph Otinos, your host, Emotional Touchstone, and welcome to the Lobot Lounge and the Gentlemen Nerds. Gentlemen,
yay.
Good to see you.
Hey, everybody. Yes. Long time no talk. I'm so sorry it's been so long.
Yeah, we've had stuff in life and what have you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But man, okay, so I did a little Pixar opening. There's so much to talk about with Pixar. We've never done a Pixar show, but I do want to focus on The Incredibles 2 since that's their latest or 20th film. And I know, Aaron, it is your absolute The original one in 2004 was your absolute favorite superhero movie, hands down.
Absolutely favorite superhero movie, including live action animation. My favorite.
Wow.
Which, by the way, this is what I always dreamed a Fantastic Four movie would be like. We haven't had that yet, but that in my mind, that is what a Fantastic Four movie would aspire to be like.
Yeah, because of the family bonds and the relationships and things like that. I mean, it is incredibly in depth for an animated film. And let's talk briefly about your love for this film, and how you see it as being a superhero movie versus a family drama, which it has both.
Right. Well, I mean, it is both, and I think that's what I respond to it. We are not. I mean, right off the bat, it's. It does what so many superhero movie fans, including I think Mark has voiced this before, wish they would do. Mm-hmm. It doesn't tell you how they got their powers. It's not an origin story. Right. We know nothing about why they're super. It doesn't introduce their first villain or whatever. We jump into a world that is already existing. These guys have been around for years. They've been fighting supervillains for years. And I believe at the time when it came out, it was the first superhero movie that kind of did that, that sort of just put us right in the world. I mean, I think now more superhero movies are sort of doing that. I mean, the newest iteration of Spider-Man didn't bother with his origin, thank God. We've seen it so many times already. So right off the bat, I knew that, like, okay, this is amazing. I know what superheroes are. I grew up with them, reading Marvel and DC and watching all the cartoons on Saturday. So I didn't need a primer. I don't need to be prepared for what a superhero movie is. And Pixar did me the honor of acknowledging that information and that experience and my intelligence, and they just threw me right in there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so we are given fully formed, who is it, Venus from the brow of Zeus, fully formed this amazing superhero universe and world.
Not to be contradictory, but I'm Greek. It was Athena who came from Zeus's head.
I'm so sorry. Yeah, Venus came out of the clamshell. You're right. Yeah. I was confused those two. Athena, fully formed. I just loved everything about that. I mean, I'm right in the middle of it. And then, of course, it starts what? Yes, there's a beautiful action sequence, but he's on his way to a wedding.
Yeah.
And so, and again, weddings are not something you normally see in superhero stories. Weddings tend to be special events in the comics when, you know, Peter Parker married Mary Jane, or when you know, this person married, the Scarlet Witch married Vision, or, you know, those are always
Or when Reed Richards married Sue Storm.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, I love it. And so that's what we're introduced with. And then boom. 15 years later, 20 years later, whatever it is, and there is, for all practical purposes, Superman crammed into this tiny little office selling insurance.
Okay, so let's take that image. I'm going to jump to Mr. Finn, because you have some thoughts about the original Incredible, because we're going to start with the original, just a brief overview or kind of a set up to launch an Incredibles 2, because it's been 14 years.
Yeah.
It's taken them a long time to get this out. So, you know, as much as we love these characters and we love the setup that Pixar gives us with this superhero world, this universe that, for me at least, seems timeless. It's weird because it looks very like Fleischer 40s, but also there's technology for today. So it's a very unique world that they dwell in. So and Mr. Finn, what do you think about Mr. Incredible, his first appearance, as Aaron described him?
Well, it's wonderful. And I'll go ahead and tell you, this is my favorite Pixar movie as well.
Really? Yes.
Yeah.
My favorite Pixar as well.
Yeah. It may not be my favorite superhero movie, but it's emphatically my favorite Pixar movie, because it's one of those times where, you know, there's that old saying about the, sum being greater than its parts. In this case, I think the parts are equal to the sum, everything from the, and I don't know that it's 40s so much as it's, I think, 60s, of mid-century science fiction cool, you know.
They actually I was watching a show about the Incredibles 2, and they gave the date. I believe it's like the when it starts, before it jumps 15 years, it's like 1954, I believe.
Okay. So it's the height.
It has a 50s vibe. Yes.
It's mid-century is what we call that in the design world. So having Mr. Incredible start out on camera in black and white, fumbling with his microphone, and then, you know, we zip forward, you know, he's put on some weight, you know, his hairline's receding. They picked the perfect voice for Craig T. Nelson. Yeah. And I like the fact that the entire film essentially is in media res. You know, it's so smart. And it doesn't insult our intelligence. So I love the fact that that not only do we see Bob just beat down by it all, and then all of a sudden, you know, this ding. Okay, well, I want to say that there's nothing we can do, but if I'd really like to tell you about the form that you can. Here, write this down. You know, genius, smart.
Yeah.
And then the follow up to it with again Lawrence Shawn and this beautiful voice, you know, his little diminutive quizzling of a boss, you know, they're penetrating the bureaucracy, you know.
Yes.
And that whole, you know, but I thought our job was to help people. Legally I'm required to say yes.
You know? Yes.
So good. Everything from the lawsuit of the superheroes to that interaction basically establishes the cynicism of this world. It's a cynical movie which I find fascinating. You know, we focus on the hope and we love these characters because they're not cynical, but they are operating in a very cynical, very selfish place, you know, and that's what underscores the selflessness of them, you know. During the rebuke scene where Bob is just chafing because he can't go stop the mugging, and they run away, and it's no one died. They just beat the guy up and took his money, but that trembling anger, they got away, you know. You know, at that point, if you don't like Mr. Incredible, you're dead inside, you know.
And that's what I'm talking about, the beauty of that world creation, because another movie, a lesser movie, would have wanted us to spend a bunch of time with a character to get to know them and to see how hopeful they were, and this is amazing cinematic storytelling in 5-10 minutes. Sure. We already know who these people are, and that is a feat. Oh my gosh! You know, as a screenwriter, believe me, that is a feat.
It is effortless, and they do that very well. They do that very well, and it's an anachronistic 1962. I mean, there are cell phones and technologies and things like that you're like, what is going on here? So it is a little confusing, but yes, it is. It's set in the 60s for sure, and in terms of Pixar's storytelling ability, you just made me think of this, Aaron. So I wanted to jump in real quick. If you, anyone listening to the sound of my voice, does not shed a tear or at least get the wet eyes during the first 10 minutes of Up, I don't want to know you. I do not want to know you. Please never talk to me.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's right? True.
That's a litmus test for humanity. It is.
How can you watch that and not like, but the movie hasn't even freaking started and you're just like, what the hell, Pixar? Yeah.
In fact, I'm convinced that they're going to use the first 10 minutes of that movie to identify the space lizards among us. You know, when it's time to find, we've been taken over. Show them that movie. He didn't cry. Take him away. Have him arrested.
But just what you talked about in that short time period to establish, you know, without a shadow of a doubt, you know who these people are by pauses, by emotion. Pixar's are so very good and almost Harryhausen like, if you will, excuse the reference. But again, Monsters, Inc., man, love to Harryhausen all over that movie.
Yep.
But just, and by that I mean, in Harryhausen animated his creatures for those stop motion movies, the slightest move, a shift, a body turn, something like that would identify an emotion that he made these things come to life. Pixar does this with their animated feet, their animated characters. They're so subtle in the way they move, a head turn or an eye wink or a squint. In the movie Coco, which I just recently saw, which is, God, I love that movie. That might be my favorite Pixar film. I'm not sure yet. But anyway, there's a moment where Coco, the great-grandmother, is listening to a song that reminds her of her father. And her hand moves. It's so subtle. Her hand starts to move up, and her mouth starts to crack and smile. And it's I'm weeping. I'm just going, oh my God, you know, by a moving hand. It's because they do it so well. They layer these stories and these characters so well. And there's got to be a movie. I mean, there's got to be these movies aren't written by committee, I don't think. I think they're written beginning, middle, and end, and then filled in these great details.
Yes.
You know, there's got to be.
There's a bunch of making of, Pixar movies that are included in the DVDs. Ratatouille is a particularly good one.
I
would recommend everybody watch the making of Ratatouille, because it does show you they do have an iteration process where they have the core of the story, the spine of the story, just like you described, Joseph.
Yeah.
And then they look at what works best for each particular sequence. So they'll storyboard it out, and then they go pretty extensively and pretty exhaustively through each sequence trying to figure out, and the secret, you nailed it. Pixar figured out that movies are emotions. That's what they are. It's a bunch of light and sound and movement that all equals to an emotion. If it doesn't evoke an emotion in you, then that's where you get the complaints of, a lot of effects and explosions, but I didn't care. Well, without that emotion, you can have a $250 million movie full of effects and no one will care.
Yeah,
just as well.
That's right.
So, yeah. Actually, although I kind of like Justice League. So anyway, but that's the secret. That is the secret. Without the emotion, all the rest of it doesn't matter. And so Pixar has become experts at zeroing in on what is it that we want the audience to feel in this sequence. Sometimes even in these particular 2 or 3 seconds of animation, what do we want the audience to feel? And it's astounding. It's just they've nailed it time after time with the subtlety of a character's movement, or the hand, as you described, Joseph, lifting, or the smile and the music, because you know what she's thinking about and you know why she's experiencing that. And all of us can relate to somebody that we miss and think about, whether it's a smell that reminds us, or a song, or a moment, whatever it is. So it's that beauty, the ability to be able to do that. That's magic. That is true artistry. And Pixar nails it. Well, it. I think incredible. The original Incredibles is filled with that kind of thing. You know, the moment, one of my favorite moments in the Incredibles, and I think Mark, you and I have talked about this, and I think it's one of your favorites too, is after he gets the message from Mirage that sends him the invitation that says, "Hey, we want to meet with you. The supers aren't gone. You know, we want to bring them back." And then he looks up at his wall, and it's all of his exploits that are splashed against this wall: newspaper clippings, magazine covers, toys, pictures that have been drawn of him by children. You know, and then the music as it swells, and the look on his face—it's pure wonder. He is as much in wonder of these moments as we are.
Yeah,
and it's beautiful. If you watch that scene and you don't get inspired, you don't get goosebumps, maybe a tear doesn't form on your eye, then yeah, you're a space lizard.
I like that scene, but my favorite in The Incredibles is after Helen goes to rescue Bob. And yes. And the kids have tagged along, and they're all fighting about it, and they're on the island, and she's got to go find Daddy. You know, yeah. I wanted to go, "Come on, Junior, we're going to find Daddy." But it would have been awesome. Yeah. But I know we can't do that. But the scene where she tells Dash, you know, "If you get into trouble, you run." And he said, "As fast as I can." She said, "As fast as you can." Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then when the murder bots start chasing him, and he's literally running for his life. And I forget, he's having fun, but he's nervous, he's scared. But then there's the scene where he takes off and he's running on the water, and he looks down and he sees that he's running on the water. He's running so fast that he's not breaking the surface tension of the water. And he kind of goes, and goes faster.
Oh, and yeah. And the music at that point, the music
swells. That's when the Michael Giacchino stuff kicks in.
Yeah, absolutely.
But again,
emotion of that moment, wonder of that moment.
For me, that I'm going,
The original Incredibles had a moment for me that I love, that Dash moment, that sound of his laughter. But there, for me, the one that gave me the misties is when Mr. Incredible, the strongest guy there, because he's all strength. That's his thing. It's strength and power. When he tells his wife, "I cannot lose you again." And he says, "I'm not strong enough. I'm not strong." And he says it so quietly, so subdued, so humble before her. And it's, oh God, that moment is so, so powerful.
Emotion, fellas.
You know, dripping with it. Yeah.
And it's funny that all our favorite moments, you know, aren't really necessarily tied to an action sequence. Yes, Dash is going through an action sequence, but the moment where he's just running and has that incredible, joyous little boy laughter, just it's great. It's great. Yeah. We're all describing moments of high emotion.
Yeah.
Incredibles is very, very cool. But yeah,
Incredibles 2 opens pretty much right where Incredibles leaves off. After the syndrome is dispatched, and the family is together again, and it opens at a a parking lot after the game and who should appear. But the Underminer, this villain we've never heard of before, voiced by Pixar Good Luck Charm John Ratzenberger. And the Underminer comes up. He makes the announcement. And this is the end of the original Incredibles. And they all sort of slap their masks on and take the pose. And, you know, we know where we're going here. So that's where it ends. 14 years later, we get to see the battle with the Underminer. We get to see what happens, you know, and it's wonderful. And that's one of those things that I enjoy them spreading that universe out a bit, because the Underminer, apparently the way that Incredibles 2 opens, the Underminer has been around. It's not like he's a brand new villain, because Mr. Incredible like talks to him like he knows him, you know, like, oh, you again, Underminer. Because at the end of Incredibles, I'm like, oh, who's this guy? You never seen this guy before, and it's brand new. No, he's not. He's a villain. He's coming back. You know, he's doing his thing. So the Underminer's got these great, like, jackhammer hands, which I thought was a really cool bit. When he's fighting with Mr. Incredible, he launches his little metal hands like jackhammers. And he's like the Fantastic Four's mole man, you know?
In fact, that is exactly who he is, a tip of the hat to.
Oh, yeah, he's no doubt.
Absolutely mole man, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that goes well. I like that sequence. And, of course, the drama starts to weed its way in, the human drama, when Violet and the boy that she likes and who finally asks her on a date witnesses this thing and sees Violet without her mask. And we launch into a subplot that comes back later on, you know, again. So, and it opens so well. It doesn't even actually open with that battle. It opens with the telling the story of that battle coming from this boy who witnessed this, you know? Yeah. And it's a great way to frame the opening of this movie. With a little nod to Men in Black, I think, with the memory wipe. But, yes. You know, totally.
Where he says, I think the kid even says something like, "Oh, I'll never forget that as long as I live." It's like, that's great. And then the flipping now of the roles. Is I think something that and apparently again as you pointed out, Joseph. 15 years since the last one. So it's not like Brad Bird had not been thinking about this. And I'm sure Disney and Pixar were probably like, "Hey, you know, Brad, we really could use a sequel to The Incredibles." Mm-hmm. So, and according to stuff I've read, they went through several iterations of a potential story and back and forth. And, you know, how far do we pick up right where we left off? Do we pick up many years later? You know, what's the new drama? What's the new tension? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I do think that continuing them in the world where superheroes were still illegal, it was not something that had been brought back into the common good. Was smart because it continues to give them something to strive for, you know. Otherwise, it's now just another Marvel DC universe, right, where they're superheroes and villains show up and they fight them. So I think it was smart to give them something, like we're still fighting for something, for not just villains, but we're trying to achieve something. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty smart. But it give I did hear some criticism of that, because it also means that since we have had no time pass between the first and the second, mm-hmm. Mr. Incredible's reactions to having his wife picked over him, mm-hmm. And to give her a chance to sort of be the hero and be in the spotlight, Bob doesn't take that well. Bob's a dick about that.
A little bit, yeah.
He is. But not understandably so. I mean, yes, understandably so. He wants to support her. He wants to give her his complete support. But there's that moment of well, darn it, you know, that was supposed to be me, kind of thing.
Yeah. Mark, you were making a sound. Do you disagree with that?
I disagree with the criticism that Bob suddenly turned into an asshole. Watching the movie, my read on that was not that she was not capable, but that he really wanted to do it. I mean, that was the whole point of the first movie, you know, kind of sneaking around behind her back, you know, so that so that nobody got in trouble. And people always forget the scene in the first movie where his handler, you know, says, we got to move you guys, Bob, we can't keep doing this, you know? Yeah. So that's the whole reason why they're on the down low, you know? Mm-hmm. I didn't read it so much as I'm better than my wife. I read it so much as I really want to do this because I want to do it.
But I guess my take on that is, because I do agree that he's a bit of an asshole, but not he's a bit of an asshole because, you know, right, you can't do it. No, I think he believes she can do it. And in fact, his fear, really what chews at his core, is that she may be better at it than he is. So what he's reacting to is not, God, why her? You know, no, it's like, oh shoot, wait, no. I'm Mr. Incredible. See, I got the big muscles and I look really good and I'm really good at this. And he's being told, well, yes, but there's a lot of collateral damage and you're expensive. That's right. And so I think it's not, his reaction, and it's a very human one, is not, I'm an asshole not because I think my wife is not as good as I am or can't do it. Mm-hmm. It's jealousy. It's, yeah. No, that should be me. And that's what I mean when he becomes a bit of, instead of like, you know what? No, hey, honey, you know, you got this. You're going to be great at this. Go. He says things like, okay, we'll go out and do good, but don't do too good. It's that kind of thing.
Not wanting to bring our real lives into this conversation, but I would imagine it would be something like, and you know, this is not me casting aspersions on anybody. It'd be something like, Aaron, your wife gets a call and they say, you are the greatest. You're going to get an opportunity to write a screenplay for a major Hollywood picture. Come out and do it. And you'd be like, that's great, honey.
Yes.
Super. I'm so in love with you and you're doing great. You know, it would be like
there,
that, right?
There is no doubt in my mind that I would be very Bob-like in my responses to a situation like that. No, you nailed it. Absolutely. Yeah. I'd be like, oh, that's wonderful. You know? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So again, it's not that I don't love Blythe. It's not that I don't think she can do it. It's not that I don't want to give her my complete support, but oh my God, why is that not me?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, it's not an emotion that looks good on our hero. But I think a lot of people were ready to throw him under the bus for not being woke enough.
And that's the part I did object to, Mark. That is not my read on his reaction.
Right.
It's not that, oh, you know, Helen deserves a better husband than him. I'm like, oh, give me a fucking break. He's human. Right. He's human. And we've just seen all the stuff that he risked in the first movie, because keep in mind, there's no break from the first to the second movie.
That's right.
We've just seen what he's willing to risk because he wants to be a hero again and he wants to be out in the spotlight again. Mm-hmm. So yeah, don't judge him too harshly when he has that yanked from him and he reacts in a very human way.
But he also grows in that too, because now he's doing Helen's job.
Absolutely.
And he's like, I got this, whatever. I'm Mr. Incredible. I'm incredible at everything. And midway through the film, he is a walking dead man. He's like, I can't, I'm math and Violet and Jack, and it's just, oh my God, he's walking. And it's the classic role reversal where Mr. Mom suddenly has to take care of the kids and goes, oh my God, you've been doing this? How the hell have you been doing this? Because this is incredibly hard, you know, taking care of a family, being a stay-at-home mom or dad. So he gets his moment too to realize, you know what? I respect this. This is, and he becomes proud of what he does, the work he does. He manages to achieve something that makes him feel proud to be a dad. When Violet tells him, you're a super dad, you know, because he feels bad that he's failing. He thinks he's failing as a father because he can't do what his wife does. Uh-huh. You know, and that's the moments. Those are those moments that make Incredibles 2 rich in these characters, you know.
Yep. Makes them very human. And again, to point out, Helen's reaction to that is not, oh, you've got this, honey. You're going to be so good.
Exactly.
You know? No, Helen's reaction is like, what did you do? How did you mess up?
Can I, you want me to come? I'll come home. You want me to come home?
Yeah,
I'll come
exactly. home. Yeah, so yeah. She's doing the same thing. She's, yep. she is questioning whether Bob is up to the task of yep. doing the stuff that she used to do. And so, yeah, I mean, her reaction is very human. Oh my gosh, you know, I knew this was a bad idea because Bob cannot handle the stuff that I can do with the kids. He doesn't have that same ability. And so, yes, to say that both of them learn something in that movie, both of them appreciate a different perspective, is correct. That's exactly what I think Brad Bird intended for the audience to see, is that they get an understanding of each other's point of view. And that's why their marriage and ultimately their family is so successful, because everybody appreciates what the other person does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's what I meant by, because I did read it and it was harsh. Mark was correct. The criticism of Mr. Incredible was really harsh from certain sections of fandom. And yes, I got the impression they were complaining that Mr. Incredible was not as woke as he should have been. And to me, coming from the perspective of a guy that grew up in the 50s, meaning Mr. Incredible, and was around that mentality of the 50s and now 60s, uh-huh. it makes perfect sense that he have the reactions that he has. But he learns from them and he adapts. And he changes and he starts to become woke. And I think it's more interesting to see a character become woke than one that already starts out, you know, woke AF. That to me is boring. Who cares? What has he learned? What's his journey? What has he accomplished?
Right. There's no growth. Well, right. I love, you know, in both movies do something very well, which is world building. Mm-hmm. And the world building in The Incredibles 2 is just as on point as in the first one. And I love that we're still dealing with the repercussions of previous mistakes. You know, that's kind of the idea. I always felt that the Incredibles was sort of a lighter commentary on superheroes, but very much in the style of Watchmen, mostly because, you know, Edna Mole has a problem with capes.
Yes.
And she doesn't reference Dollar Bill, aka, you know, from the Watchmen, but basically, you know, they make the same observation. And so I love the idea that our villain or villains in this case have a grudge in the same way that Buddy had a grudge, kind of different, a different spin on that angle, and so the everything from the introduction of the kind of League of Exceptionally Interesting new heroes that, yes. you know, that vomit and fart, you know, but the design elements continue to be just absolutely on point. And that's one of the things that makes these movies such a joy to go back into that world. It's sort of like, to me, this is the future if Benton Quest had designed it.
Which there's a whole lot of love for Quest in this film, isn't
there? And a direct call out for anybody who was like, well, I don't really see it. No, it's on the TV set in this one.
Yeah.
Shut the hell up.
And in the background, there's a building that says Quest Enterprises. It's yes. just, you know, just, it. Yeah, there's no doubt. There's no doubt that this is absolutely, you know, that feel of watching that old Johnny Quest stuff for
yep.
sure.
Yep. Yeah. Oh yeah. Sure. No. I thought that when I saw the first one, you know, it's yeah. like, oh, holy cow. Okay. They're really capturing that feel of those 60s era cartoons that we grew up with and really like.
And Giacchino has mentioned specifically Hoyt Curtin's soundtrack to Johnny Quest. Again, for those of us in our late 40s to early to mid 50s, we hold these truths to be self-evident. For those of you who don't know anything, let me assure you that there were cartoons before Rick and Morty, and some of them were pretty good.
Yeah. Yes.
Amen. Hey, let's raise our glasses to that one. I like that. Amen to that. Chin.
As it yes.
So let's talk about Jack-Jack. Because okay. I think it says Jack-Jack kind of steals the show a bit in yes. much in the vein of entertainment and plot. We yeah. saw Jack-Jack's powers at the end of the first Incredibles, but other than Syndrome, no one else saw that. Because it was yep. way up in the sky when Jack-Jack started exhibiting the powers when Syndrome tried to kidnap him. And of course, Syndrome ended up on the wrong end of an airplane motor or a turbine or whatever. So he's not talking. So yep. and there was a short film released with Jack-Jack being the star with a babysitter experiencing right. Jack-Jack's powers.
Jack-Jack attacks. Yeah.
Right. So after that, we really didn't, you know, I assumed that the Incredibles knew Jack-Jack had powers, that Mr. and Mrs. Incredible knew. But apparently not. Apparently because it takes up right after the first one ends, they don't know quite yet. So the Jack-Jack attack movie could be after this movie or, you know, it could be in between. It could be after. We don't really know.
Well, but, if you watch The Incredibles and uh-huh. and you see Helen checking her voicemail,
right?
And you can hear the babysitter calling.
That's right.
Yeah, she gets back more and more panicked.
Yeah.
Yes. That
was the other side of that. Yeah.
That's right.
I rewatched the movie just before seeing Incredibles uh-huh. 2. So
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yep,
okay.
Yep, that's it. Yeah.
So when our heroes in this one, in Incredibles 2, find out that Jack-Jack has powers, Mr. Incredible is overjoyed. His first reaction is joy. You know, you have powers. You know, he's yeah. so happy. It's a little bit of a shock, but then eventually, okay, so what can you do? You can teleport. That's great. You know, what else can you do? And I'm sorry, but I can watch that fight with Jack-Jack and the raccoon. I can watch that thing over and over and over again. Good God, that's funny.
Wasn't that amazing?
So much fun. Because, you know, as a father, my first reaction is don't let him wrestle with a raccoon. But then I thought, no, he's a super baby. He's going to be yeah. fine. He's going to be fine. The raccoon, however, is going to be in a world art.
That was so hilarious. That little raccoon. Oh, my God. What an inspired sequence that was.
Yeah. That was a very fun.
It was inspired. I feel like it was borderline precious. And certainly fits the arc of an action sequence in the film, we'll keep going. Like
it sounds like you weren't particularly fond of it, and here's the reason that I would have hesitation to go. You know, I mean, as much as I love that sequence, it did go on a little long, but the reason it did is because they had to show us his powers. So he goes through the litany of his powers. During yeah. that battle, he discovers things he's never done before. And he's like, oh, I could do this and I could do that. I could burst into flames. I could shoot lasers out of my eyes. I could teleport. I can, you know, multiply myself. Like, you know, the powers just come full stream out of him as he needs them, which right. is kind of fun to see. And the raccoon's reactions to these things is also just priceless. And yes, it's a little precious, but it's also hilarious.
That yeah, like, and that's,
you know, what the hell?
Right. That's why I don't mind that it's, I mean, yeah. yes, they're clearly, this serves no other purpose. Well, yeah, like you pointed out, it does show us, it's preparing us to see, oh, here's the stuff that Jack-Jack can do that will obviously come into play later on in the plot. But its purpose is to entertain, to make us laugh, because, you know, otherwise he could have used his powers in another situation, right? But the reactions of the raccoon, the animations of the raccoon,
yeah.
it's just, oh my God, it was so freaking funny. I was a big fan of that sequence.
So our villain in this film, and this is the one criticism that I probably have on this movie, was transparent from the beginning. If right. you don't know who the villain is from the beginning, you're not paying attention, and you don't know movies. It was fairly obvious to me who the villain was. Right. I'm not going to spoil it. Well, maybe I will. I don't know.
Yeah, come on. We can talk about spoilers.
We can talk about
spoilers. Because I actually do want to talk about this with you, Joseph, because I share a little bit, it seems, I share a little bit of your thoughts. So go ahead. Finish your...
Yeah, to have the villain... It was... Winston DeVore, voiced by Bob Odenkirk, they launch him out as this guy's the rich guy with all the technology and he loves supers and he makes the call, he brings them together, he starts the ball rolling. Very, very classic. Oh, it's like Last Crusade, the guy who's sending him on the mission is actually the villain. Well, very shortly after that, the minute his sister arrives, Evelyn, whenever Evelyn walks in the door, voiced by Catherine Keener, you go, oh, no, never mind. That's her. It's right off. She's stumbling. She's dropping things, you know, red herring. She's dripping red herring all the time, you know, and you're like, it's too much of a red herring for her to be dripping. It's obviously her, you know, and then the technology, her attitude as she sits back and watches her bonding with Elastigirl, you know, the girl kind of thing. And, oh, really? You think he's going to do that? Well, let's do that. You know, I'll help you catch this guy. Oh, no. It's you. Right. It's obviously you.
Yeah. And by the way, to strengthen your point there, Joseph, I mean, Elena's not unsmart about plot. I mean, she lives with a screenwriter. We talk about plot all the time and story. But yeah, when they introduced those two characters and, you know, we were not that far into the movie, Elena leaned over and said, it's the sister.
Yeah.
And I went, wow. Okay. Hold on. I had not even quite made that determination yet. And she just leaned right over and said, it's the sister. And I went, oh, okay.
Literally.
And she was right.
The minute that she walks in and starts dropping things and clumsily reaching around, I went, nope. Yeah. That is too much of a look at this character. Nah, she's a goofball. Maybe I'm jaded. Maybe I've seen far too many of these things, but.
And we have.
I didn't mind it. I was waiting anxiously for the reveal, you know, and I got my wish. I wish she wasn't so Bond villainy, you know, walking around with Mrs. Incredible in the frozen area and talking to her about the reasons her, this is my grand plot and what I'm going to do. And there was a little bit of that.
And honestly, that part didn't bother me as much, you know, the Bond villain thing, because at least in the Bond villains, they're a little more straightforward about, you know, what their plan is. I mean, the part that kind of, and it didn't even bother me. Let's be very clear. Yeah. I really liked The Incredibles 2. I thought it was a wonderful sequel to my favorite Pixar movie. However, if I almost wish, and by the way, I'm about to do something that I hate when other people do and rewrite the movie. But I almost wish that she had been a straightforward villain who just doesn't want supers to come back into the spotlight. And these two forces had been at odds. I think that creates a much more dynamic situation than, oh, there's this villain. I wonder who it is. I don't know. But here, sit in this chair, Helen, and let me try this experimental, you know, thought helmet on you, whatever.
Right. Yeah,
that's the part that bothered me. It's like, no, you know, embrace it.
Pick a character that
opposes what they're trying to do.
Yeah,
in the open.
Let me from the beginning.
For you. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say real quick, if I could, before you go, what if Winston? And we're rewriting here. What if Winston, who brought them in and started this whole process, we don't see the sister. We just see the screen slaver. And it comes out later in the movie that he goes, I know who it is. And he tells them, it's my sister. He sets it up.
That's brilliant.
Where screen slaver has been out there already doing this thing.
And I think that would have been way better.
Imagine the levels of Winston saying, don't kill him. Don't hurt him. We have to capture him. And he's like, you know, kind of protecting a little bit and kind of, there's always maybe we see a picture or he talks about the founding of my company with my sister, blah, blah, blah. And that's it. We don't have to see the sister.
I think that is so much better. If they were sibling millionaires, one dedicating themselves to stopping superheroes, one dedicating himself to bringing them back. Because I don't even mind their motivations. The reasons why they hated and loved, that's fine. I love that.
Go ahead.
No, it's okay. That right there is what I was going to say. I do like the idea that he figures it out and tells them that would have been a nice turn. But the fact is, she is not fighting the super. She's fighting her strong-willed, kind of dim-witted brother.
Right.
She's not opposing the super. She's opposing him. She can't stop him from spending the money and doing the thing, so she's going to have to go about it another way. I wish they had articulated that better, but I think that's what they were going for.
I would say her motivation, yes, but wouldn't you, and this is what I came away with it, very much like Batman, the death of her parents affected her to the point where she's anti-super. Because she felt her father was so dependent on supers where he could have gone into the panic room and saved their lives. But instead he said, no, the superheroes will save me. And they didn't. So that, I think, is a little bit of a basis for her, anti-Batman.
Now that you've introduced that element, Joseph, I think, man, that is absolutely the way to go. If she was a vocal public enemy of getting rid of the ban on superheroes, and her brother's like, oh yes, it's my sister, and you know, we've disagreed about this our entire lives, and here's why, and here's what happened. And then she's still trying to use her technology to turn the heroes and make them bad, to discredit them. And maybe she has her own team of supers that serve her purpose and all that. But again, be more in the open with it. It's okay to show us, oh, she's the bad guy. She is the bad guy. And now it's these two forces are on a collision course. I did enjoy, except that Elena ruined it for me. I did enjoy who is this guy? Who is the guy that's taking over the transmissions and saying these things? Right, screen slaver. Like, you know. So I did like the mystery was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But
the cynicism is still in there. You don't hear it as it's not as strident, but all of the screen slaver's rants are very much aimed at 2018. And our dependency to screens. And you spend all this time staring at them, you know. Those aren't even subtle points.
I mean, to find out that, like, if and again, God, I'm not going to be able to get rid of this, Joseph's idea now, but to find out that that character was real, it wasn't just some pizza guy. Mm-hmm. He was a real character, but he's being secretly funded by the sister. Mm-hmm. Again, that already we're creating a more interesting dynamic. And then you could even have a thing where, you know, that moment where Screenslaver decides, I've grown beyond you, I don't need your money anymore. And maybe there's tension there, and maybe the sister herself becomes imperiled by the things that are going on and has to rely again on the supers to save her, kind of thing, the thing that she hated. There's just so many ways that this could have gone that I think would have satisfied me a little bit more. Again, I thought it was a really wonderful movie.
I do not want to rewrite the movie so much as I actually want us to all go back in time. Yeah. My problem with this movie is one that cannot be fixed with writing. It can only be fixed with a DeLorean. And that is, this movie should have come out 4 years after the first one.
No, if you're right.
I know where you're going.
If this movie had come out in 2008, we would have cheered. We would have praised it. We would have thought that Brad Bird can do no wrong. It would have been the most awesome thing ever, because we were not in the Marvel era yet.
Right.
And I think that some of the oxygen for this movie has been absorbed by the fact that, in 2008, we started getting superhero movies that were, in fact, a lot closer to what we wanted in terms of a superhero film. They had the heart, they had the drama, they had the humor, they had the pathos, they had all of that. Yeah. And it didn't help that after this movie came out, there were 3 Fantastic Four movies that all sucked green donkeys. They were for a little Wayne World shout out for all of you out there. The thing that made the Incredibles such a good film and to this day continues to be such a good film is there weren't a lot of examples prior to it. We had one Spider-Man We had two Spider-Mans and two X-Men movies. And so we were right on the edge of these things. Spider-Man 3 hadn't come out. X3 hadn't come out. Elektra hadn't come out. Daredevil hadn't come out. Incredibles kind of sits in this liminal space of possibility where you go, oh, wow, this is the next iteration. Yep. And so to wait 14 years and get something that feels like 2007, that's where the disappointment comes in. Mm-hmm. And I almost wish, and keep in mind, I liked it too, but there's a part of me that wishes they hadn't done another one. Mm-hmm. Because now I've got to look at these two things and reconcile them as a fan. And I when Incredibles 2 comes out, I'm going to watch them both back to back and see if they play better back to back. As one continuous thing.
Here's my warning on that, because this is where I thought you were going, and I'll share my the first half of Incredibles 2. I was so distracted by the age of the voices I was hearing.
Oh, interesting. Particularly
Craig T. Nelson. Now, I could have been affected because prior to the screening, there was a behind the scenes short that they showed at the Alamo. And you saw Craig T. Nelson in the recording booth with Holly Hunter, and you went, oh, my God, he's old. He's old. I mean, look at him. He's an old man. Yeah. So the minute Mr. Incredible opened his mouth in Incredibles 2, the first words out of his mouth, I went, oh, my God, he sounds old. Because I was picturing, and I'm going to hear it back to back, but I'm wondering if in 14 years, if you hear a difference in their vocal intonations, Holly Hunter, as much as I love her, sometimes I want to say, spit those rocks out of your mouth, because I can't understand what you're saying. You know, sometimes, not all the time. Mind you, midway through the movie, all that was gone and I was loving it. But I just, it struck me. I thought, oh my God.
I would agree with Mark. I mean, you know, in fact, I would even go so far as to say that Marvel movies were very much inspired by the template of Incredibles. Mm-hmm. They looked at how Pixar used humor and action sequence and characterization said, that's what we need for our movies. That's how we need to do our Marvel movies.
Well, you may be onto something here, because as I have pointed out previously about the Marvel movies, they all have a familial component to them.
Yeah.
Whether it's filial piety or the loss of a parent or a replacement for a parent, and of course the Incredibles is all about the family unit. And I think what makes this all more galling is the fact that there were two different attempts at a Fantastic Four franchise, three Fantastic Four movies in toto. Right. And apparently they were made in a pocket universe where the Incredibles did not exist. I don't understand. Right. I don't understand how you can say, you know what we need to do? We need to make a Fantastic Four movie. Well, what we should do is watch The Incredibles. Oh, no, we're not going to watch The Incredibles. Let's do something totally different.
Yeah.
So, or read an old Fantastic Four comic book. Let's not do that either.
Please. No, I think we know a little something about making movies, okay?
And by the way, to show that even later Marvel movies, definitely inspired by The Incredibles as opposed to the earlier ones, there is a shift in tone from the first Thor, the first Captain America, you know what I mean? To later, like to now, Ant-Man and Wasp, the Avengers, the Spider-Man movies, they have that. They've got the humor down. You know, even the new iteration of Thor Ragnarok, which so many people hated. But it has, if I dare say it, an Incredibles vibe to it, where it's funny. It's about family. It's about, you know, their relationships with each other. I mean, it's like they finally started focusing on the right things, and they never forgot, hey, we got to make them smile.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because when I was rewatching The Incredibles, and at the beginning of the movie where he's fumbling with Mike going, sorry, yeah, you can break through walls, but you can't make this thing, you know, and it's a great little moment, right? You know, I can't get the mic on. I'm super strong, but I'm having trouble with this really small thing. And then contrast that with the opening sequence to Thor Ragnarok, where he's spinning on the chain slowly. Sorry, hold on. Yeah. I swear to God, I'm not doing doing this.
Exactly. Yeah, that level of humor.
It's that little tiny, yeah.
It's wonderful. And it's not, if you go back and watch the early Marvel films, it's not present in the early Marvel films. Mm-hmm. And it starts to really, really come to the fore, I would say, with Whedon's first Avengers. Whedon's first Avengers is when they... because he, God, who understands that humor and family better than Joss Whedon, he really brought that to the fore. Mm-hmm. And so, later of Marvel movies really are getting that formula right. You know, even Civil War, which we covered on this show not that long ago, which is so dark and grim and dreary. There's so much humor Civil War. It must be there. It's got to be there, or we feel stifled and we drown. Yeah.
Would you move the seat up?
Nope.
The what now?
Oh yeah, can you move the seat up? Nope.
Yeah. Exactly. In the midst of all that. Yeah. Well, gentlemen, we are. There's a large red robot that's moving our way. So let's have some final words here before that light up eye makes me tinkle myself. He's a scary guy. I don't want any part of that. Final words on The Incredibles. I mean, or just Pixar in general and the future possibly of Pixar and animation and how animation plays, such an important part in our movie going experience. Just whatever you want to say.
Here's what I hope. Here's what I truly hope for Incredibles, specifically Incredibles. Yeah. Disney keeps talking about this new streaming channel that they're going to roll out, and they're going to need a bunch of different content for it. And of course, who has more properties than Disney? No one. I would love to see, with the same level of care and detail that was given to shows like Justice League or Justice League Unlimited or even the old Superman and Batman animated shows, mm-hmm. I would love to see an Incredibles television, animated television show, where we see the weekly adventures of this family, of the kids, developing more of the world, meeting more supers. It's a fully fledged, fully formed, fully conceived world. Use it, put it out there and you can gear the shows more towards a younger audience with a lot more humor, make them a lot more fun. Mm-hmm. That is what I would love to see, fellows. I would love to see an Incredibles, a TV animated movie that Disney can put on their streaming channel. I would sign up for the Disney streaming service just for that.
Mark, what do you think?
Well, two real quick things. Pixar movies are like pizza that is being delivered to your home. When it's good, it's fantastic. When they're bad, they're still pretty good. I think a few studios can say that your least favorite Pixar is still really watchable and you watched it three times. Mm-hmm. So that's an amazing accomplishment. My final thought is for Brad Bird. I don't care what you do with the next movie. If you want to move them up a few years so that Violet is a senior and Jack's in junior high and going through adolescence and Jack is now the age that Dash is, if you want to just pick up right where you left off, I don't care. Do me a favor, please do not wait another 14 freaking years.
Amen. See,
Let's shoot for a 3 to 4 year window like the rest of the Pixar films. Okay.
Amen.
I mean, this was not rocket science and you didn't have to make it that way. Yeah. So please don't do that again. All right.
And we say this, Brad, as complete, absolute fans of your work, your genius, your talent. We want to see more of your work. That's what we're saying. Oh my God, we love you. Please do more stuff.
Yes. Get over yourself and write the next one.
I want to see, and I'd love to see this in the Incredibles universe. I want to see a League of Villains. Good God, I want to see a League of Villains. I want to see a League of Villains in some movie, any movie. I don't care, superhero, live action, something. I've always been kind of really fascinated with like the Legion of Doom or the Masters of Evil from Marvel. When villains go, you know what? All these guys are getting together and they're kicking our ass. Let's do that too. So let's see villains get together, because I've always found, and this is where Venture Brothers does such a wonderful job, the animated show Venture Brothers. You get to see some of these villains interacting and how they talk to each other, because they're all a-holes, all of them. Yeah. So putting a bunch of a-holes in a room with powers and personalities and very strong opinions about, you know, my hero is tougher than your hero, stuff like that. I love that. I love it. I think it's fascinating because villains make the movie for me. They just do.
Well, if DC continues to make their films, the last Justice League definitely promised the Legion of Doom. Oh, come on. I haven't given – if I haven't given up on those movies, you can't give up on those movies.
Oh, I can – here's what I saw – side note. Here's where I finally saw Justice League on a plane flight to Athens, Greece. That was when I was like, oh, it's free? I'll watch it.
Oh, God.
That is literally when I saw it. That's literally when I saw it.
Well, they are promising a Legion of Doom. And in the hands, in the hands of the proper writer and director, I think they can have a fantastic Justice League movie.
They're not going to show me what I want. I guarantee you. Legion of Doom, great. You'll go, hey, look, the Legion of Doom, awesome. They're not going to show me what I want. They're not going to show me the behind closed doors in that Legion of Doom. They're not. They're going to be like,
maybe not.
God, and it's going to kill me because the opportunity there, just that short interaction, Lex Luthor and Deathstroke was kind of cool. I thought, oh, look, they're talking to each other and they're like, what are you doing here, Luthor? I'm doing great. I digress. Ladies and gentlemen, The Gentleman Nerds is a Cloak and Dagger production and written by Aaron DiArrive, Mark Finn, Ben Gibbs, and Joseph Fotinos, with additional material by Remy the Rat and Wall-E. Music composed and performed by the amazingly talented Ben Gibbs. Promotional material, logos, and The Gentleman Nerds mascot, still with no name, created by artistic goddess Michelle Fitzpatrick. The Lobot Lounge bouncer is Maximilian, and our special guest bartender was John Ratzenberger, our good luck charm. Our sound editor, mixer, and intentional producer is Ben Gibbs. Our executive producer and the man we all pray never gets superpowers is Aaron DiArrive. The Gentleman Nerd's attorney is Dr. Gonzo. Luxo Jr. was the first CGI film nominated for an Academy Award. Buzz Lightyear's facial features are loosely based after Lasseter. And Brad Bird himself provides the voice for Edna Mode. Oh, and by the way, Mark Farnash is the man in the gorilla suit. Web hosting by Rustix Interactive. Technical assistance provided by Blythe Christopher Villarive. The next Pixar film comes out in June 2019, Toy Story 4. Join us in the Lobot Lounge when we next open, and please always remember to tip your bartenders and your waitstaff. I'm Joseph Martinez, reminding you all that Red Skull lives. I love my Logan's Run Sandman sleeper gun.
Yep.
That's a t-shirt.
Deep sleep gun is what they're called.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Yes, when they pry it from my cold, dead hands.
There you go.
My cold, dead, flashing palm hand.
Yes. There you go.
Yeah.